This is XTP Media.
You're listening to Extended. Your hosts, Peter Johnson from XTP Media, Gareth Stringer from Global Aviation Resource, and Tim Robinson from the Royal Aeronautical Society.
Hello there, I'm Peter Johnson, and welcome to this extra episode, episode 54 of Aerospace Radio Station Extended. This extra episode is the first of two features on the Space Shuttle. Today I get to speak to Jeanette Remack, who's a military aviation historian, writer, author and artist. From her experience in doing research for her books and for the museum she's worked with, 8 years ago she and her co-author formed Phoenix Aviation Research. On a case-by-case basis, they provide historical research services for other writers, researchers and historians. She also maintains her artwork under Phoenix Aviation's banner. Jeanette has studied fine art at the School of Visual Arts in New York City. She has a degree in commercial photography, and she obtained her master's degree in aviation sciences in 2000 from Northwestern International University. Her many accomplishments are listed in the Who's Who Among American Women 1994 to 1995. Today, we look back on NASA and the shuttle disasters and the demise of the US manned space program in her book, To Slip the Surly Bonds. Jeanette, welcome to Extended.
Thank you, Peter.
It's great having you on. Thanks for calling in from New York this morning. But before we look at the shuttle story, tell us a little bit about your aviation career.
Well, let's see. Joe and I started Phoenix Aviation Research about 25 years ago when we decided we were going to start writing. That had to do with the XB-70. I was in love with the XB-70 Valkyrie, and that's how Joe and I actually met. Joe was the former curator at the National Museum of the United States Air Force up at Wright-Patterson on Dayton, Ohio. And we started Phoenix. We started writing. We also do research for film and TV. We've worked on a number of movies and TV shows. I have, I just finished an episode for Air Warriors on Smithsonian. That's going to be coming up, I think, the end of March. So that was like, I really enjoyed that immensely. I've worked on films like Medal of Honor. And we've done TV shows here in New York and things like that. Let's see, I also am an aviation artist. I work with the United States Air Force Art Program and proud of it since 1988. I have a number of paintings in the program. We just had a new book come out by Timothy Kett called A Magnificent Showcase, if anybody wants to take a look at it. A lot of our work is in there. It's a glorious book. It's really beautiful.
And some of your work, Jeanette, is presented in, is it the U.S. Air Force Museum?
Yes, it is. In the U.S. Air Force Museum, in exhibitions throughout the Air Force at the different bases and the different museums within the Air Force program.
Yeah. Now, I do want to come back at some time in the future and talk to you about your other books, but you mentioned one there on the Valkyrie. I think everyone has an interest in that. Can you tell us just a little bit about how you came about writing books like that?
Well, actually, it started out as a painting. It started out as a painting. I had fell in love with a photograph of the XB-70 that I saw in an aviation magazine, and I was just hot to see this bird. I just had to see her. So I called into Washington to the Air Force, and I said, where is she? Because at that point, you know, I didn't know too much about museums or anything like that. I was new at this game. And they said, well, she's up at Wright-Patterson. Why don't you go up and see her? We'll set it up for you. So I went up. And I met Joe, and Joe took me into the modern flight hangar, and there she was. And, of course, I don't know if you know about the Jesus Christ legend.
No, I don't.
What happens is there's a story. There's a little thing that goes on with the XB70. She has a legend that goes with her of being called the savior. And the reason for that is every time everybody's the first time that you walk in and you see her, she is so huge, so enormous, so mind blowing that everybody has the same thing. They go, Jesus Christ. Well, Joe did not tell me anything about that legend. When he took me in, I actually stood there and I fell for it. I went, Jesus Christ, look at the size of this girl. She's so big, you know. And he just cracked up laughing. And that's when he told me about the legend of the Savior. He says, yes, this is a well-known thing. So when I actually got a good look at her, at her size, and I realized what I saw in the photograph was nothing compared to what she truly is, three stories off the ground, 190 feet long, you know, 160 foot wingspan. She's just glorious. And yeah, at that point, I decided, okay, now I'm going to do her portrait. So I made some quick sketches, did some photographs, whatever, went back and did the painting, presented the painting to the Air Force. They loved it. And I was one of the first women artists to go into the Air Force art program. Remember, this is 1988. So yeah, there were a lot of women that were painting airplanes at that point. And from there, I went on to paint more famous aircraft that were in the museum. I would go back and research their history, find out what made them famous and why, and, you know, do the portraits, which also went into the program and are now part of the Air Force legend in there, as they say. So, the XB-70 was a big point for Joe and I. He loved her. I loved her. I didn't understand much about her. And of course, in doing the painting, I had to research. And as I started researching, I accumulated this mass amount of material. And Joe knew about it. We talked about it back and forth. And I said, hey, you know, I said, we really should write a book. And he went, nah. I said, yeah, we should write a book. You think? Yeah. Okay. We sat down. We started to write a book. Not, you know, I mean, this was new to us. We didn't know.
Yeah.
I took the book to MBI, which is Motor Books Publishing, and they bought it. And that was the start of it all, you know.
Well, it's quite a special book, and we do maybe want to have a chat about that sometime in the future.
We actually have another book on the XB-70 coming out in June. It's called
–
the first book is The Ride to Valhalla. The second book is The Return to Valhalla. And it's sort of a more precise, more – initially what we wrote with XB-70 Valkyrie Ride was a military history. It had never been done like that before. So this time around, we added in a few more things that were not brought out in the first book that got edited out that we weren't – you know, we couldn't use because we went over word count and things like that. But this time we got to do it our way. So that's going to be coming out in June, and that's going to be to celebrate her moving into the new research and development hangar at the Air Force Museum. This is their fourth building now, and they're going to be opening it in June. The official opening is in June, so the book will be ready for that.
So let's come back to what we want to talk about today, and that's your book, To Slip the Surly Bonds. And that's a detailed account, of course, of the shuttle from design through to, sadly, the disasters. To go back and to put this into context, where did the problems start?
The problems, Peter, actually started when NASA started. NASA was an act of desperation from the Eisenhower administration. Eisenhower knew he had a problem with the Soviets and with, you know, of course, Sputnik coming out. Our missile system was not working. He needed to get satellites up there because he was always afraid that, you know, he was going to have another Pearl Harbor on his hands. He was kind of paranoid about that. And he decided he was going to come up with a civilian agency. The big thing with Eisenhower, too, is that he did not want to have the military involved in space. He did not want to have a military space race. That was his biggest fear.
Yeah.
So he came up with the idea of creating NASA as a civilian agency in the form of what NACA was, which was the National Advisory Council on Aeronautics, which goes back to the 1914s into the 1950s, 60s. He wanted something along that line that he knew he could depend on. Well, okay, June 29th, 1958, NASA is signed into law. But what was NASA really? Oh, sure, in the beginning of the book, you will see everything that NASA was supposed to be.
Yeah.
But the one thing that he didn't give it was a mission. NASA had no mission statement. So basically, you have this new civilian organization. You have a new civilian director who really didn't know much. Keith Glennon, who was the first director, really didn't have a lot of science background or any aerospace background. So he really didn't know what he was getting into. And now you have, well, we got to beat the Soviets. We got to do something. Okay. So NASA comes into being and it's floundering. It doesn't really know what it's going to do. Eisenhower says, we need a missile program. We're going to get Wernher von Braun in there. And, of course, you know about Operation Paperclip and how
sure.
we go, you know, Wernher von Braun. Put him in charge of the Redstone program. And hence, the Redstone program rolled over into what would be the Marshall Space Flight Center, what would become the Marshall Space Flight Center.
Yeah.
At the same time, we had Kurt DeBus, another amazing guy, down in Florida trying to pick up the bits and pieces and find a place to put Cape Canaveral because they needed a launch point. The spaces that they had in Virginia were not enough. They needed to go to bigger rockets. Of course, the Air Force was exploring. They had their own little launch pad over on Canaveral, but it was like it was the U.S. It was the Air Force spaceport. It had nothing to do with Canaveral per se. So DeBus was trying to put together the bits and pieces with nothing, literally nothing. They had no utilities, no people, no idea of where they were going to get cable to lay groundwork. He had nothing. Kurt DeBus put together Cape Canaveral finally. And of course, we had Houston and, of course, Washington, D.C. So those are really the first forerunners of NASA. And as they're coming together, you see the Air Force is now really ticked off. Why? Well, here comes the CIA. The CIA took away their reconnaissance because they came in with the U-2, the A-12, and the Keyhole satellites, okay? And that took away their reconnaissance, which ticked them off badly. And now you've got a civilian agency that's going to be playing with their rockets. Whoa, we're not happy with this, you know? So the Air Force was really not pleased with this whole thing. So there was a lot of angst between NASA and the Air Force. So as we come out of the Mercury and the Gemini, to make a long story short, while we did have support for Mercury, we did have support for Gemini, here comes Apollo. Now you have a president that's got John F. Kennedy who comes in. He's got problems himself. What's he got? He's got the Bay of Pigs. He's got an almost nuclear war. He had to do something to take the mind of the people off his problems. So what did he do? He goes to his vice president, Lyndon Baines Johnson, who was always for the space program and actually became the head of the program because he was the vice president, which is now something that just transcends down the line. Every vice president is the head of the NASA space program. Okay.
Right. Okay.
It's a title that just happens. And LBJ said, well, what do you want me to do? He says, I want you to go out there and find me something that I can use. Find me something. What can we put on the plate right now that we can show our people that we're just as good as the Ruskies?
Yeah.
Lyndon Baines Johnson goes out there. He digs around. Well, you know, the moon. Okay, the moon. Let's sell the moon.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard. Because that goal will serve to organize and measure the best of our energies and skills. Because that challenge is one that we're willing to accept, one we are unwilling to postpone, and one we intend to win, and the others too.
Unfortunately, JFK was assassinated. The moon program was in its infancy. They were just starting to roll into the development of Apollo and what it was going to be and all of the history that goes to that. But now you have a president that's assassinated, a very much loved president that was assassinated. And what happens? Well, we have to do something to memorialize this president. This was his dream. We have to give him the moon.
Hmm.
Okay. Congress goes to work and the money starts rolling in.
Yeah.
NASA now has funding unbelievable, like they've never seen in their life. Excellent. They're ready to rock. They go in. They start building and building and building, and they get the moonshot ready. And fortunately for us, we had our failures, of course, Apollo 204. You know, we lost three astronauts there.
Yeah.
But we moved on from that point. So that was the first of NASA's problems, which I will come back to. NASA, again, is now thrown into this huge ball of wax of where we have to come up with a moon program. But NASA had internal issues. And I guess that's what I want to get to.
Yeah.
The centers, the NASA centers, Marshall, Johnson Space Flight, and of course Kennedy, which was now the Kennedy Space Center, had a real communication problem.
Just to understand, what were the specialisms? Why were there three different centers? How does that come about?
Marshall Space Flight would handle everything to do with building rockets. Why? Because Wernher von Braun was in charge there.
Right.
That's how he came into his milieu, all right?
Yeah.
Now you have Johnson Space Flight, which is down in Texas. That was the home of where the astronauts were coming to train.
Right.
This is where they would go to do all the head work and the body work and the different clinics and things that they had to go to. What was Kennedy? Kennedy Space Center was now the launch center, okay? Yeah. Cape Canaveral now became the spaceport for the United States. They were launching their missiles from there, their satellites, you know, the whole thing. So this is why NASA now had different centers. And, of course, it went on. We had the Dryden Space Flight Center, which was a research center. We had the Lewis Center, which was also a research center. All these other centers were cropping up, but the big boys were Marshall, Johnson Space Flight Center, and, of course, Kennedy.
Yeah.
So these three were really the heart and soul of what was going on, okay? But there was a problem with it. Everybody protected their own turf.
Hmm.
Marshall was very adamant about the way they did things. Kennedy was adamant about the way they did things. Johnson wanted things done their way, but would not give anybody a chance to come into, you know, changing anything.
Yeah.
They would not change their way of doing things. So now you got three centers. You have all these people that are not really communicating with each other. It's called bureaucracy.
Yeah.
And that was one of the main big things that happened with early NASA. When NASA was coming out of Mercury, Gemini into Apollo. Apollo became so big so fast that this bureaucracy just grew.
Yeah.
And what happens with bureaucracies? It's like a fungus, you know? It just keeps growing. If you don't clean it, it just keeps growing.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, it led to accidents. It led to things happening. And we lost astronauts.
And of course, you know, when we look at Apollo, although most of us, you know, doing the Monday morning quarterback call, mm-hmm. look back on it quite fondly, there were some serious warnings, weren't there, of course.
There were some very serious warnings.
Apollo 1 and also Apollo 13 spring to mind. But NASA got through that predominantly by funding and goodwill from around the country, but after Apollo had gone, NASA had nothing.
That's right.
And the shuttle was the next thing on the drawing board. Let's move on to that then and talk about how the shuttle came about. The point you made about the US Air Force earlier on, to get the shuttle approved, NASA needed the US Air Force, didn't it?
Oh, they needed them in the worst way, and the Air Force knew it.
Yeah.
And they used it.
Yeah.
They used it. Now they were the customer. So now they, when the shuttle came in, you have to remember too that it started really in the late 60s when they were looking at single stage to orbit. The Air Force was exploring that. NASA was kind of working on lifting bodies and you know, different types of research, which was fine because it all helped the shuttle in the long run. But the Air Force, when it took a look at what the shuttle plan was going to be, they said, well, We're not going to work with that.
Yeah.
We want a bigger bay. We need a bigger service bay.
Yeah.
By the way, we also want to use Vandenberg Air Force Base as our launch point because we want to do polar orbits.
Yeah.
Why do we want to do polar orbits? Well, we need a polar orbit because we want to look at certain parts of the USSR, and we can't put our satellites up there to do that unless we use a polar orbit, and you can't give us that from Kennedy.
Jeanette, just to understand that better then, Kennedy is predominantly where it is and why it's there because it launches out over the Atlantic, because originally it was a missile based range,
test range,
but also that gives it's the equatorial orbits, isn't it, that go down, that go that way, which is predominantly where a large amount of satellite and other low Earth orbit activity takes place. The US Air Force wanted polar orbits, which required them to launch in a different direction, and therefore Vandenberg became the chosen option for them. There was another thing, and you do talk about it a fair bit in the book, but just to help us understand it, the issue of cross range and payload. Payload was because they needed bigger satellites because of the technology they were using, so I understand that. But what was this issue with cross range?
Basically, what that meant was, if you look at it this way, you launch from the West Coast, Vandenberg, okay? You get your polar orbit, you put your satellite, or you return your satellite, whatever it comes to. Now, when the shuttle comes home, you want it to return to Vandenberg. You're not going to land it at KSC, all right? So you're not going to go to the East Coast, you're going to go to the West Coast, which means you're going to have to travel an extra, let's say, 1,100 miles.
Yeah.
In order to get back to Vandenberg or Edwards in case of a problem, because Edwards was right behind them. So they needed that extra 1,100 miles in there to get back to Vandenberg so that they could bring their satellite back or do whatever it is that they had to do.
Right.
So they were requiring that they have this cross range.
And of course, in the very original designs of the shuttle, the shuttle was actually powered, wasn't it? It was designed to be powered, and so there, there was the thinking that it could potentially power its way back to certain locations, but that didn't really happen. Let's look at the decision that's then been made. The US Air Force support the shuttle; it can get its funding to go into design. Let's look at the design of the shuttle, because there's some significant milestones in that come back later at a later date. And I want to take a quote from the book that says, "Even though the shuttle looked like an aircraft, she was not. The orbiter was just that—a spacecraft that looked like an aircraft." It started off being designed as both a rocket, a powered aircraft, but was never one or the other, was it?
No, not really. I mean, for all intents and purposes, the shuttle is a spacecraft. That is what she did. That is what she is. That is what she was called. That's not what they initially wanted.
Yeah.
What they wanted was something equivalent to a single stage to orbit, which means, you know, you're going to go in, you're going to take off, you're going to come back, you're going to land. You don't need any secondary launch accoutrements like an external tank or a solid rocket motor. You know, this is what you were going to do.
Yeah.
But the problem with that was payload. You could only carry a small amount. That wasn't going to work. If you wanted to have this humongous satellite, how are you going to get this out? No, you would have to launch it. You had no choice. So in order to better, I guess, manipulate that, they decided to go the way they went with the external tank and the solid rocket motors and the shuttle as more or less an empty shell to carry whatever it was going to carry.
Yeah, okay.
Either a satellite or, you know, like with the ISS space parts to go up there or whatever.
Yeah. But in this design process, and you go into it in a fair bit of detail in the book, although to be fair, just to say this to anyone listening, this is not a technical book. There's enough technical data for the reader to understand the challenges, but it's not a design manual.
That's right.
Yeah.
It's a history.
It really is. So just taking that on board, because of the point about, you know, she's not an aircraft, she is a spacecraft, there were some fundamental design flaws from the very beginning that were known, weren't there? The wing design, the tile design, and the one that kept on coming back to me, and I talked to somebody separately about this, that was the fact that, in effect, the airframe was made from aluminium rather than titanium.
That's right. I guess the easiest way to do this is to start with the aluminum airframe first.
Right.
Well, let me start with the wing. okay, since that really initially the shuttle was going to have what they felt would be a straight wing. Max Faget, who of course everyone knows who Max Faget is, was a tremendous aerospace designer, worked for NASA, worked on his own, you know, great mind, came up with a design along with other designs for a straight wing for the shuttle. But at looking at this, the Air Force said, nah, we need a delta. Yeah. And they said, well, NASA looked at it and said, well, you know, a delta wing, that's going to be more weight. It's, you know, a million and other things. Air Force said, we want a delta wing, and that's it. Okay, so they go back, they hit the drawing board, and they look at it, and they say, well, Rockwell, who was the orbiter's designer, went back and looked and said, this is what we can do for you. We can give you a 50% blended delta. And what that basically means is that when you look at the shuttle, you look at the trailing edge of the shuttle, the trailing edge of the wing has elevons on it, and it is a straight edge. You look at the rest of the wing is a planned form for a delta wing,
yeah.
Okay, which is like a triangle, okay, and it blends into the fuselage, okay? So it's not just a wing box sitting, you know, a wing box and a wing sitting on a wing box.
Yeah.
It's now blended physically into the fuselage, which gave it a good type of look, not only look, but also efficiently helped the shuttle fly. Okay.
Yeah.
So the Air Force accepted that. That was a good design as far as Rockwell came up with. The only problem was with the Delta Wing too, is that you now had to protect that Delta Wing.
Yeah.
And now we can get into the titanium aluminum issue. When I first started researching this book, I had that question because I had worked a lot on the A-12 Blackbird, which was the big mama of the SR-71 that no one knew about.
Yeah,
she was a CIA bird, you know that. As I got into the A-12 and I did a lot of research on Kelly Johnson and how he designed it and why he used titanium and the problems with titanium, question came back to me when I wrote the shuttle book. Why did they not use titanium instead of aluminum? I got my answer, but I got my answer in a very strange way. I talked to NASA, I talked to Kennedy, I talked to some of the designers. Nobody was really willing to give me a straight answer. Oh, well, we used aluminum. It was cost effective. That was the answer I got. And I said, no good. I kept looking. When the shuttle program closed out, they took all of their material and they gave it to a couple of the universities down in Texas. So I did some digging. And I did some real heavy digging. And at the bottom of the pile, I found my answer. There was a gentleman by the name of Bob Thompson, who was the shuttle program director from, I believe, 1970 to 1981, thereabouts. And he said, quote, we're going to build her like we're going to build an airplane. Nothing more than that. Just simply, we're building another airplane. It's going to be aluminum, and we're going to build her like an airplane. I sat there and I read this about three or four times and I said, this is bizarre.
Yeah.
I went further. I found the cost extensions of how much extra it would be to use titanium instead of aluminum. I talked to a friend of mine who worked for Martin Marietta and knows the shuttle inside and out. He worked on the program and I said, look, this doesn't make any sense. You know as well as I do, titanium alloy can be made to anything you want. You could use marine titanium. It depends on what alloy you put into the titanium. You can use that for anything you want.
Yeah.
Why wouldn't they do it?
One of the key things as well here, Jeanette, that I was talking to in fact, actually, the guys who support the show, who are firemen. Mm. And I asked him that very question. He said, it's very simple. Aluminium burns at one temperature. Titanium burns at a much higher temperature, I think two or threefold higher. So therefore, in terms of use for rockets and more importantly, re-entry heat, mm-hmm. titanium to him seemed like a very obvious thing to use. And when I
exactly.
said to him, did you know the shuttles were made out of aluminium? We've had a very interesting debate about burning. And that comes back later, doesn't it? Because
yes,
around everything then, the frame of this craft is built and hangs off of. And so therein lies one of the first fundamental issues with the shuttle design. And that
it's the main issue. Because the reasoning behind this, to cut to it, is the NASA engineers were not comfortable working with titanium. That was what I did find out from someone else I had interviewed. And that person told me that they really didn't understand titanium and all the different alloys that could be used to create, you know, whatever it was that they needed, whatever temperature range they needed.
Yeah.
They just didn't understand it. And besides that, you know, aluminum was available. It was easy. It was something they knew.
Yeah.
So they were going to, quote, build her like an airplane.
Yeah. Okay.
But she wasn't.
Well, no, she certainly wasn't, and suffered as a result of that. Then let's just, before we finish off talking about design and go on to talk about the manufacturing, because there too were inherent some very odd decisions. Let's talk about the tiles. Obviously, everybody understands that the shuttle had challenges with the tiles. I think what's less well known, though, is the design of the tile was originally to, in effect, stick it onto the airframe, proved to be unsuccessful. And in effect, a blanket was wrapped around the airframe, and then the tiles were glued to that, which gave it both additional strength as well as additional protection. However, the fundamental tile design was inherently wrong.
For the people that are listening that don't know what a shuttle tile might feel like, it feels like styrofoam. It's kind of chalky. It's brittle. And it does feel like styrofoam. There were some 122,000 tiles, I believe, on the shuttle, and it would take 17,000 man hours to inspect and repair those tiles. So you can figure that out.
Yeah.
To put one tile would take 3 days. The products they were using are going to shock you. The one product that they used to stick on the, quote, stick on the tiles was a type of caulking material, an RTV material. Those in airplanes know what I mean when I say RTV. It's like a caulking material that you would use in the bathroom, you know, that you would, you know, put around your sink and stuff like that.
Yeah.
It's something akin to that. It's a plasticized type of product. And a lot of times, if the technician wasn't fast enough, it would dry. So it wouldn't stick.
Right.
So they would literally spit on it to keep it moist.
Yes, I did.
And then stick
I did read
down.
That, and I certainly was flabbergasted by it. I genuinely thought that that was madness. But as you go on in the book, you're not joking.
I'm not joking.
No.
And there was, of course, you know, there were like four different types of tiles for four different sections. You know, one is a high heat, one's a low heat, another one's like a medium heat, you know, and they have different places. For the underside of the shuttle, that's the black part.
Yeah.
They were having an issue. So what they did is they went out and they would buy cases of Scotchgard. That's the stuff that you spray on your couch or your rug so that when the cat hacks up a hairball, you know, it doesn't stick, you know, that kind of thing. They actually went out and bought this off the shelf and sprayed the bottom part of the shuttle with this, quote, Scotchgard.
Right.
To keep it, you know, to give it a little bit more, whatever you want. It definitely wasn't for heat purposes. It was just to keep it stuck in there, okay, to give it a smooth surface. So the tiles, yes, the tiles were a big issue.
Now, Jeanette, you mentioned there are four types of tiles. One of the decisions that was made, and I was absolutely shocked about, was because of cost, because there was a lot of pressure on cost and, more importantly, time as well. The decision was made not to coat the whole of the orbiter in protective tiles, but rather to use, let's just say, the stronger and more resilient tiles on the underside. Now, we all recognize the shuttle and the orbiter as a result of that, but actually that's not how it should have been originally. It should have been protected and better protected all over. Again,
exactly.
We know, we've talked about the wing, we've talked about the leading edge, and sadly we'll come back to Columbia in a little bit. That came home to roost, didn't it? Because the tiles there were not as strong.
That's right. And what would happen would be if a tile fell off, let's say, you know what would happen? You got to remember when the shuttle's on the launch pad, there's a lot of ice, there's a lot of water.
Yeah.
She could be out there too during a thunderstorm, whatever. These tiles were extremely porous, so they would soak up water.
Yeah.
And in soaking up that water, once she hit space, what would it do? Freeze, right?
Yeah.
What happens when it freezes? It contracts.
Yeah.
What happens? It breaks.
Yeah.
And then you have what's known as the zipper effect. If one tile should break, crack, fall off, piece of it, whatever, that opens up an area where these super hot gases that are in reentry can just take this, get in there, and literally, like a zipper, just open up the rest of the tile so that everything comes off. And the painful part of this is that they saw that there was something wrong with this in the first flight of Columbia on the back of the SCA, which is the 747 that carried the shuttles back and forth. Okay, yeah. They saw it after the first flight of Columbia on the back of the SCA. Now, understand, she didn't do reentry. She didn't do anything.
Sorry, that was Enterprise, wasn't it?
That was Columbia's first time they had Columbia on the SCA.
Right.
The first time they put Columbia on her back.
Right, and that was to move it to flying it cross country to.
That was just testing. That was bringing it back and stuff like that.
Right. Okay. Right. I understand.
And they saw over 100 tiles just gone. Hundreds of tiles just gone. Now, considering there was no reentry, there was no vibration.
Hmm.
Except for flying the S, you know, flying on the SCA, that's about it.
Yeah.
Didn't that tell you something?
I mean,
it's sort of like, oh, wait a minute, don't we need to look at this?
Well, let's pause there then, Jeanette. Mm-hmm. We'll take a little break, and then afterwards we'll come back to the manufacturing of the three main elements of the orbiter, and of course flight and the disasters.
Event Fire Solutions is an independent fire and rescue service providing both preventative and reactive emergency services across the UK. As well as our main event management, we provide the support and equipment to deliver a safe and risk-free event. From fire appliances to medical vehicles, our fully trained and accredited staff will make your event a true success. If you need risk-related advice, investigation, medical or fire training, then we can deliver this for you. From the office to the airfield, we have the experience and the accreditation and most of all the skills to make your workplace event safe and risk-free. To find out more of how we can help you, look us up at eventfiresolutions.co.uk.
From across the globe, from the centre of aerospace, and now to you.
The Royal Aeronautical Society has a range of specialist groups, which focus on a specific domain or discipline. They form a vital interface between the society and the world at large, and serve both the interests of enthusiasts and professionals through debate, conferences, lectures and other activities. Learn how you can get involved. Visit www.aerosociety.com.
So, Jeanette, just before we leave the design stage and talk about manufacturing and, of course, flight, we talked there about the tiles, we talked about the wing and the structure of the orbiter. The one thing, of course, that we all look back and very sadly reflect on is the fact that there was no way for the astronauts to survive any sort of issue. And of course, there were abort issues on the pad, many abort issues. And sadly, of course, the two incidents, the astronauts had no chance. There was no escape, was there?
No, there wasn't. There wasn't.
Even Apollo had its various systems for getting the pilot the astronauts away, but there's one statement in the book that I literally could not believe, and the escape system was you run as fast as you can away from away from whatever's happening,
and that
whatever's literally
happening.
It's not the quote, but that's what was said. That was the instruction: run as fast as you can, as far away as you can. And I was absolutely flabbergasted by that. I didn't realise. But let's move on and talk about manufacturing. Of course, there's three main elements to the system. There is the orbiter, of course. There's the external tank and there's the solid rocket boosters. Let's talk about the orbiter first. That went to Rockwell to build, but very quickly, because of politics and because of all sorts of other challenges, it got subcontracted out. So Grumman built the wing, McDonnell Douglas the maneuvering system, Fairchild Republic, yes, the wing, and Convair, the mid-fuselage, on and on and on. I think did I read somewhere there was 180 subcontractors for the program. Overlaying that then with the three centres, and of course the fact that the politicians all wanted manufacturing in their states, they wanted employment, they wanted links to it, this became additional layers of bureaucracy. And I think one of the things that really stood out to me when reading the book was the challenges the contractors had of getting change mechanisms in place, feeding back some of the best practice, getting some new ideas. It just simply didn't happen, did it?
No, it didn't. It was build it and shut up.
Yeah.
If we have a change, we'll let you know.
Yeah.
And of course, there was the pressure of time. It was the pressure of cost. It was the pressure of this has to happen. I mean, just the way that the solid rocket motors were transported was a prescription for disaster in itself.
Yeah.
Most people think that the solid rocket motors came in one big long stack and that's how they were delivered by a barge. Not so. They actually came in these chunks of segments, like big lifesavers that were put on railway cars and then shipped down to Canaveral. Okay. And then when they got to a certain point, then they would get on a barge and they would take them over the, you know,
yeah,
one of the over to the Canaveral to be assembled. And when doing that, they were being laid on their sides, which, of course, if you have something that's a perfect round and you lay it on your side, what happens?
Yeah.
It becomes an ovoid, right?
Yeah, it distorts. So now you had it. Yeah.
That also added into a lot of the problems with the rubber O-rings and how that happened.
Yeah.
You know,
but even the choices of some of these contracts, I was absolutely shocked. And I know I keep saying this, you know, the external tank that went to Martin Marietta,
you know,
that was because it was cheap, but nobody believed that they could actually deliver it at that price, even though it was not the best solution. It was the cheapest solution.
It was the cheapest solution. But isn't that the way everything's done as far as the government concerned? I mean, every aircraft you fly out there goes to the lowest bidder.
Yeah.
You know, that's the scary part.
But as you know, I'm jumping around here, but as you keep stating in the book, the shuttle was not an operational craft. It was never approved as an operational craft. It was always in its test and development
phase. It was always a research and development issue. While it was operational, it was always a work in progress.
Yeah.
It was never, this is the final stage of the shuttle. There never was that.
Yeah.
There never was that.
Yeah, and even though there were 130 plus flights, very little of the best practice and innovation to making it better really happened, did it?
Well, there was. I mean, the sad part was that Columbia had just gotten a brand new glass cockpit, and then, of course, we lost her.
Yeah, I suppose that was a bit of a sweeping statement. Let's go back to the SRBs then. Thiokol was appointed the contractor to bid that, but it wasn't the best bid by a long way.
No.
And the decision was challenged by Lockheed, but that was overturned. But one of Lockheed's biggest challenges against the appointment of Thiokol was that they'd never built a solid rocket booster of that size at all. So not only were they cheap, they'd never done it before. And I think that came home to roost as well, didn't it?
Well, it did, because you had James Fletcher, who was also the director of NASA at that point, but he was also on the source evaluation board that took a look at all the bids and went through them one by one and said, oh, this one, this one, this one. And if you look at the point system that they did, you know, like Lockheed got 710 points. They gave Thiokol 714 points. They gave the next guy, whoever it was, 700. And Aerojet, I think, got 655 points. So this is how they broke it down. But there was some game playing going on there, too.
Yeah.
You have to remember that James Fletcher was a big man in Utah. He was a Mormon. He made no you know, bones about it. He was a Mormon, but he was also a son of the city, meaning that he wanted to make sure that, you know, Utah was going to get the best bet here. And he had pressure. He had a lot of pressure from Senator Frank Moss, who was the head of the Aeronautics and Space Council for Congress. And because of a lot of this pressure, and the letter is printed in the book.
Yes, it is.
It's a very interesting letter. And it's a very interesting letter. It kind of shows you just how things were getting done.
Yeah.
You know, Thiokol got the job, but the only thing that they had experience with was the Minuteman missile and the Poseidon missile. And that was nothing like an SRB.
No, it wasn't at all. And let's just for a moment put into, we talked about the tiles because we're coming back to talk about Columbia in a while. Let's talk about the design of the SRBs, because it was very, very clear very early on. And again, throughout the whole of the shuttle program, throughout all of the launches, that there were problems with the O-rings. And yes. I think the majority of people understand the concept of the O-rim and how it expands and how there were challenges with the weather on that morning's launch in particular. But this problem was known. It was known throughout, but it was completely ignored.
Yes, it was completely ignored. It was known as well as October of that year, I believe, the year before, that flight had had some issues. It was brought up, and there's a thing called an in-flight anomaly form that would have been filled out. And a lot of the engineers went back and said, look, we got a problem. We want to fill out an IFA. And their boss told them, no, we don't need it. We don't need it. We don't want to. No, we're fine. We know about it. It's okay. And, of course, that IFA was never filled out. So that just shows you that, you know, the pressure to launch, to get it out, and a lot of people, you know, there's a lot of conspiracy theory about that. And I go into that in the book, too, that, oh, well, Reagan wanted it out because Kristen McAuliffe was on it, you know, first. It's a lot of bull.
Yeah.
A lot of it had to do with the fact that people were just not paying attention. The day that they could have launched, which would have been that Sunday, was a beautifully warm, clear day. They could have went that Sunday, but that was Super Bowl Sunday. Didn't want to happen.
No.
So they pushed it off. Of course, the next day it was freezing cold again.
Yeah.
And the rest is unfortunately history.
Well, let's talk about flight then. By some, and it really is interesting to see quite how much effort went into to bring in those three system elements together. I mean, there are some real heroes in here, as well as some process and system problems that just were inherent in the bureaucracy of NASA in particular at the time. So, you know, this isn't all about, you know, wasn't it a disaster and a crock? There was some monumental effort in making things happen. And we saw the first flight, of course, in 1981. I'm old enough to remember sitting down in front of the TV to watch it. There were 135, I think, shuttle.
133, I think.
Oh, right. Okay.
I could be off.
Shuttle flights. And of course, it was retired five or so years ago. We forget it was a 30-year career, which is not too bad. But there were, of course, the two catastrophic accidents. So let's look at that, because ultimately I spent the first quarter reading your book thinking, gosh, this is nothing. When am I going to get to see something on the orbiter? When am I going to? But actually it puts it into context. It builds up the challenges so that when you do understand what went wrong, you can put it into context. So let's talk about Challenger first, 1986.
T-minus 15 seconds. T-minus 10, 9, 8, 7, 6. We have main engine start. 4, 3, 2, 1, and liftoff. Liftoff of the 25th Space Shuttle mission, and it has cleared the tower.
Roger, Challenger. Control program confirmed. Challenger now heading downrange. Engines beginning throttling down now at 94%. Normal throttles for most of the flight, 104%. throttle down to 65% shortly. Engines at 65%, three engines running normally, three good fuel cells, three good APUs. Velocity 2,257 feet per second. Altitude 4.3 nautical miles. Downrange distance 3 nautical miles. Engines throttling up. Three engines now at 104%.
Challenger, go at throttle up.
Challenger, go at throttle up.
A known design fault. Was it a technical error or was it a management error?
It was both. It was actually both. It was a technical flaw. They knew about it.
Yeah.
But it comes down to management making the decision. And there was a flaw in the decision making. Larry Malloy, who was in charge at that time, was on the phone that night at a teleconference, and you have to remember the state of the art at that point, with Thiokol.
Yeah.
And Thiokol was telling them, you can't launch. We cannot back this.
Yeah.
And Malloy is going, what do you want me to do? You want me to launch in April when it's 60 degrees, 80 yeah. degrees? You know, I mean,
and he literally said
launch.
That, didn't he?
Yes, he did. He literally said that. The quote is in the book.
Yeah.
And that comes straight out of the Rogers Commission. Yeah. And so, you know, here he is, and he's pushing Thiokol to the wall, and Thiokol's telling him, look, just because we don't have every single fact and figure, which is what Roger Beaujolais, who worked for Thiokol, was trying to show them, and at that point, there wasn't a time to do all these big fancy charts and things like that. This was a matter of, we have to start tanking soon.
Yeah.
We don't have time. We got to start tanking. We have to make a decision. So tanking meaning they have to start filling the main tank. With propellant. And that took so many hours. And Beaujolais was standing there saying, look, I don't have all the paperwork here, but I'm telling you, it's not going to work.
Just to remember the context of what was happening, this was one of the coldest January mornings that
yes,
most could ever remember or had been recorded. Mm-hmm. As you mentioned earlier, that's right. The shuttle had been sitting outside for a few days. Remember that the rocket bays are cooled by water. There was a significant amount of water around. The temperature was dropping to the 30s and the 20s. But obviously in those lower areas, it was freezing even further down into the tens in some areas. The weather team had been out. There was ice all over the orbiter. They had recommended no flight. Thiokol knew that the risk to the O-ring was high. And again, put it into context. If you take a piece of rubber and put it in the freezer, when you take it out and put it in the oven, one thing happens, it has contracted and it expands rapidly. Now, there were two rings. The first one is the one we predominantly talk about, but there was, of course, a backup ring as well. But that backup ring had saved their bacon several times. I think the previous 8 or 9
yes,
flights.
That's how they got away with it.
The previous 8 or 9 flights, the first O-ring had burnt through, but there were signs that it had through soot.
It was
that
soot.
Had gone right
it, yeah.
through. And the second O-ring had saved them. The temperatures on this flight were so low that both of those O-rings were at risk and, of course, eventually failed.
Exactly.
I read the book and I literally said out loud as I was reading it, no, 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 no. I genuinely couldn't believe it. What was being said that evening as the manufacturer was saying, we recommend no flight, and the team was saying, you know, well, what do I do? Do you want to go out and tell everyone we're not going? And of course, the decision was made to fly. Now, there is one engineer at Thiokol who made it his job, and he was a specialist in this area. And sadly, he had to live with that decision. You talk a little bit about him.
Roger Beaujolais. He did live with that decision to the point that it literally broke the man's heart. After the accident, he couldn't work anymore. He's done.
Yeah.
He would stand around in his backyard and to not think. He would literally pick up rocks and just move them to another location just to keep himself busy so that he wouldn't think, because he took it on his shoulders that he knew he was right and he couldn't make them see it. And it was all because he didn't have the time to put all these charts together. And he felt it was a failure on his part. And it's a heartbreaking story.
Yeah, it is. And I recently saw, I think, an interview with him. And it was very, very sad. It was very sad because what he tried to do is he tried to stop the flight, didn't he? He did try to stop.
He tried
so hard to stop and to get people to listen because he knew what was going to happen.
It was just like he was out there banging the drum and everybody had headphones on. Nobody wanted to hear him.
Yeah.
Larry Minoy certainly didn't want to hear him. The NASA team certainly didn't want to hear him. Although there were people, and I don't want to paint NASA as everybody in NASA is an idiot or they're evil or they're part of this bureaucracy. There are hearts and souls at NASA that bleed fuel propellant. This is their life. This is their struggle. This is their work. This is their dream. This is their heart.
Yeah.
And I want to give credit to those people. I really do want to give credit to them. I don't want it to seem like everything that we're saying here is, you know, so anti-NASA. No, by no means. These people saved lives. These people tried to do what they could do, as you're going to see in Columbia. And I just want that out there, that there are people that in NASA that got past the bureaucracy. They paid for it, probably with their job, with being a whistleblower, with whatever. But there are people that truly believed in what they were doing, and they loved the program.
Yeah. Let's move on then, because time is pressing on us, sadly, Jeanette. Let's talk about Columbia, which, of course, was 7 or so years later. The shuttle didn't fly for a few years after Challenger, and it was, of course, the Rogers Commission, and you go into some detail again about that. But it hadn't quite fixed all of the bureaucracy and decision-making challenges that NASA had. Now, we've talked about the tiles, so we understand that, but Columbia was damaged from foam debris, wasn't it?
Yes, she was damaged from a foam hit.
And again, not only was it known that this could happen and was likely to happen and had happened, when Columbia launched, within minutes of it happening, the engineers were starting to advise that there was a problem.
Yes, they saw it. They saw it on the cameras. They knew it, and they started to go for it right away. They were literally begging to have more photographs taken once she hit orbit.
To
see if there was more damage. And what was happening is the front office, Ron Dittmore, who was in at that point in charge, was poo-pooing everything. And his counterpart down in Houston was also poo-pooing the idea of, like, no, we don't need this. And they were literally begging the Air Force. They went to the air, they jumped over the quote chain of command and went to the Air Force and said, please put your satellites on her so we can see. And they paid hell for that.
Yeah, they did.
Because
they did.
They paid hell for that because they jumped the chain of command to do that. And that was just a sorry thing. And the other thing with Columbia that it was unconscionable is that they never really told the astronauts the severity of the situation. They knew they had a problem, and I think they expected the astronauts to say, well, okay, I guess we buy it.
We have booster ignition and liftoff of Space Shuttle Columbia with a...
Columbia's last launch 16 days ago, a spectacular sight. What you can't see is a small piece of insulation foam which detached from the shuttle and hit the left wing. Could this have caused the catastrophic damage? NASA's investigation has only just started.
There were not many options open to them, even if they had known, but there were some options.
There could have been a second orbiter launched.
Yeah, and also there was the potential for changing the angle of attack, wasn't there?
That is correct,
also almost likely would not have worked, but at least was an option.
It might have given them a fighting chance.
Yeah, and the decisions were made not to pursue investigating these options. That's another thing I found absolutely abhorrent, really, in terms of reading this story as it unfolded. I found it very uncomfortable, actually, looking at the denials that went on as you write it in real time. It seems just impossible that this could have happened.
And it did happen, unfortunately and sadly. And I remember sitting there that Saturday morning waiting for them to come out of the blackout. And that silence was literally deafening.
Yeah.
I'll never forget it.
Yeah, it was a very sad time. I remember it too. Very, very sad time. And again, very sad for not only for those who lost their lives, but their families, because, of course, it was live as well. We'd reached that time when everything was live. And, of course, it was very clear what had happened. But let's talk about what had happened then. The foam debris had hit some tiles.
Yes.
In those areas that were vulnerable. It was known they were vulnerable. And as I mentioned earlier, I'm not saying it would have solved it, but a stronger protecting tile may potentially have protected the airframe better.
Well, what happened was there was a change in the formulation of the foam also.
Yeah.
And I think I talk about that
yes,
they
you
had
do.
Removed one of the elements from the mixture of the foam, which was applied by hand. And the reason that they had removed this particular portion of the formula was because they felt it was environmentally a problem. Well, when you look back and you consider how many shuttle launches there were a year, maybe two.
Yeah.
Okay, two, three, maybe. How much of an environmental impact is that truly?
And given that the fuels they were using were probably far more damaging
exactly.
than the small bit of foam covering.
But the real ironic part of it is that when they removed that particular element, they allowed for more voiding to happen. As they applied this foam to the outside of the external tank, it would create air holes, pockets.
Yeah.
And that's what would happen as, of course, there was tremendous vibration when the shuttle was getting ready to launch. These pieces would just bust off. They would just break right off and boom, go right down.
Yeah.
And this time around, it just hit it in the right place.
Yeah, of course. And even at the time as the craft broke up, everybody was under no illusion as to what had happened. It was very interesting to read your account of that, because as you read it, you realize they knew immediately what had happened, which meant they were in effect gambling with this, as it had been a gamble up until then. I think I read the comment more than I can remember of, well, it hasn't happened so far, so why would it happen again?
Why would it happen again? Exactly.
Yeah. When this is space, even now we don't treat space with any disrespect in terms of, the challenges that it'll cause us. So it was very sad to see that sort of thing. And as I said, the book isn't just about looking for fault in this whole regime. It's a really, really great account in detail of what happened. And I was riveted to it. But let's look then, the whole shuttle process. Did they just get away with good luck? Did they just miss out on more critical incidents? Or not? Because when I read the book, I'm astounded they got 130 plus shuttles into space and back.
They got 133 plus shuttle missions off on the backs of the tremendous engineering staff and just all the staffs of the different contractors, everyone that works on the shuttle. Accidents, unfortunately, when you go into a MALU like space, they call it the final frontier. I don't call it the final frontier. I call it one of the final frontiers. Space is nothing to screw around with in plain English.
Yeah.
You got to know what you're doing. You got to have your head screwed on straight. And unfortunately, what happened here was bureaucracy got in the way. It just tormented the system. There's no other way I can put it. If you could do 133 launches and not have an accident, that's something to say. That's a marvel. That's a magical thing.
Yeah.
But the two accidents that did happen, maybe they didn't need to happen. If some of this bureaucracy had been cut away, if some of this pork barreling had been cut away, if some of this innuendo and things that were happening in the back room had been cut away. And that was one of the things that I think really put NASA to the wall. I mean, in both the Rogers Commission and the Columbia investigation, you know, those are very thorough investigations, especially the Columbia investigation.
Yeah.
And they really tore them apart piece by piece and showed them, hey, this, and this. Even with that, NASA stood back and said, okay, now what?
So one reflection, Jeanette, and with your knowledge and experience of all of this, how do you look back on the shuttle program? Was it a success?
Unqualified success. Yeah, it was a success. It was a magical success. It gave us something we never had before. She could have gone on for at least 5 more years.
Yeah. And of course, we've got the wonderful International Space Station.
Of course, we got the space station.
Not only as a monument, but as a working example of the result of the shuttle, because it could not have been done without the shuttle.
It could not have been done without the shuttle. And we could have had 5 more years to support the ISS.
Yeah.
She's had problems up there, and we're relying on 40-year-old Soyuz technology to bring back a man like Scott Kelly, who just broke a record for being in space for a year.
Yeah.
And what does he come back in? Soyuz capsule in Kazakhstan.
Yeah.
He should have been landing in the Atlantic Ocean.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It's like, what's going on here? You know, if not the Atlantic Ocean, he should have been coming back on the shuttle. It's mind blowing.
Yeah, I do understand that. So, Jeanette, just before we go, tell me what you think about the current plans for manned space. I'll throw this one at you. I know, and I didn't expect to ask you this, but what do you think of the current commercial space program that's under development?
The current commercial space program is wondrous. I give credit to everybody. I think that they're doing an amazing job with very little, with a lot of ingenuity. I'm happy to see it. I'd love to see more, but we have a problem. It's going to take years before we're going to be able to have a commercial viable spacecraft that will be able to carry somebody back up to the ISS.
Yeah.
That is an issue. And that's where the shuttle could have come in.
Yeah,
if they would have left her for another few years just to give her the money to do whatever it is she needed to do to save her,
yeah.
You know, to make sure that the problems got fixed. And then instead of paying $63 million to the Russians to come back and forth with $63 million for each, by the way, coming and going, that money could have been used to save the program. But what happened?
Hmm. And dare I ask you what you think of SLS?
I want to see the SLS happen. I know that they're working on it. But of course, the Obama administration cut Constellation the minute he walked into office.
Yeah.
That didn't help matters. The SLS is coming together on a shoestring, which again is another prescription for disaster, to quote. I am hoping beyond hope that we will be able to come up with a heavy lift vehicle. I know that the Air Force with their X-47B has done some tremendous things with single stage to orbit. They are really doing things behind the back wall there, and I'm happy for that. I want to see Congress here in the United States, and I want to see whoever comes into the White House to open their eyes and know what a space program means to this country.
Hmm.
They need to look again and say, we belong there. We don't belong being a passenger with the Russians. We belong doing it ourselves. And commercial spaceflight right now cannot handle that load. As hard as they're trying, we're still years away. Looking at Mars for 2030, that's a wonderful thing. I don't take that away either. But you know what? 2030?
Yeah.
A lot can happen in between now and 2030.
It certainly can. Well, there's a rich heritage that's been created in things like Apollo, so there's a big expectation. But Jeanette, thank you very much for joining us. Tell us where we can find you online.
You can find all of our stuff on Amazon. You can go to we have an author's page on Amazon.com, or you can just, you know, plug in my name and find it. I have other stuff there too. I have some short papers. I have something on the TWA flight, which is TWA 800, I should say.
Yeah.
It's sort of the wires didn't do this, folks, after a lot of research into that.
Right. Well, we might want to have a chat about that at some time
as
well.
Yeah.
I'll put links to those in the show notes, by the way.
And we also have our Phoenix Aviation page, which is on Facebook. You can just Google in Phoenix Aviation Research into Facebook. It'll come right up. Come and join us. We have some beautiful, very, very extensive photo collection there. I think a lot of people would enjoy. We have a good following. People love to come and see us. And you can find us there also. And we also have our own webpage, which is, again, just Google Phoenix Aviation Research. It will come up.
Well, Jeanette, that has been an absolutely fascinating discussion. Thank you very much for joining us. And we're going to get you back on soon because there's so much more to talk about.
Thank you, Peter. I completely enjoyed it. I loved every minute.
Email us now. Get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk. And remember, there's no E at the beginning of extended. Aviation questions, suggested topics, or even good old feedback are all welcome.
We would like to thank White Hearts and Peter Dixon for their contributions to the show, and to the BBC and to NASA for using their material. You can find Extended on Stitcher.com, UKpodcast.com, thepoddirectory.com, and of course on iTunes. Our legal policy and use of our material can be found on our website, and please do ask before using anything you hear. The programme is produced with a Creative Commons licence. You can find me at NASCOT Hornet on Twitter and at xtpmedia.co.uk. With the arrival of the music, it's goodbye from me, Peter Johnson. We hope you enjoyed this extra episode. Remember, stay tuned to this frequency. That is, of course, Aerospace Radio Station Extended.
Extended would like to thank its partners, Global Aviation Resource, the Royal Aeronautical Society, and XTP Media, for their support in helping to present and produce the programme. Thanks for listening to Extended. We'll see you next time. And don't forget, we want you to contact us. So get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk is the email address you need.
This is XTP Media.